state. He's put it on the backs of the counties to pay that. And I think it's only a matter of time that the counties say that's just something they can't afford to do.
President Donald Trump, he came about because of the will of the people.
The money, I think, would be probably more significant than tolls are going to generate, although it would be for a different sector of the budget.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. On this episode, we talk politics, local, New York, and Connecticut. Wednesday night, Glenville Town Supervisor Chris Ketsley will deliver his latest State of the Town address. Ketsley, who's in his third term in the town of 30,000, also serves as chair of the Schenectady County GOP. I spoke with Ketsley on Tuesday.
I think this is a different speech for me over my 12 years or so as a supervisor, where we're going to focus mostly on our infrastructure investments that are needed in the coming years and really looking at ways of addressing some of our capital needs in our buildings.
You've been focused a lot on the need for a new town hall and also to repurpose the public safety building. Can you give us an update on those two projects?
Yeah, we're getting close now to have a final site plan for what we call a town hall campus setting, where we're going to look to separate the needs of our police department and our courts into a dedicated public safety building, which we're currently in now at town hall, and then build an administrative building for all the other services we provide to our residents through the town hall function. So it's really the most efficient, cheapest, and best use of our assets that we have, which we have vacant land already, so we don't have the acquisition cost. We have this building already, so we don't have to have that building cost. So it's really a way to save the residents the most money possible while still meeting the needs of a growing town.
What's the timeline for that?
Well, we're hopeful that, after tomorrow night, we'll get some input from the residents. We'll do a public meeting dedicated to this proposal in March when we have fine details. And then hopefully the town board would act somewhere in late spring and potentially be in the ground after final drawings in the late summer, early fall.
How are you getting along with this town board so far?
Good. We're a good group. We work well together. I think that in most cases, even the Democrats on the board have seen that we're making good progress, and they've been fairly supportive in many of our initiatives.
Just one more thing about the new town hall. Will residents see any disruption in services or anything like that as this project goes forward?
No, the good news is that we're going to be able to stage, since we have a current building, so we'll be able to build before we have to vacate, and then as we vacate after the new building's built, we'll do the renovations to the police department in stages. So there'll be no disruption and no additional cost needed for any off-site type of housing for staff.
What about commercial development in the town? Where do things stand today?
Yeah, we've really, the past 10, 11, 12 years, have seen a lot of commercial growth in the town. We're going to continue to see that, I believe. Freeman's Bridge Road corridor is our next focus. We spent a lot of time on our town center redevelopment, and that's really paid off. And we're going to try to bring the same principles to Freeman's Bridge Road and see if we can jumpstart some development on Freeman's Bridge Road in the coming years.
In an earlier story we did with you looking forward to 2020, in January, you mentioned expanding the network of trails in the town. What can you tell us about that idea?
Yeah, that's been well received by our residents. They're being used as we continue to build them out. We have a variety of proposals on the table as to where we need to fill in and start making connections. We just opened our Woodhaven Trail here on Glenridge Road to connect a major neighborhood into our town center. And what we want to do is now try to connect that town center into our parks down Van Buren, and therefore start making these connections for our residents. And folks are excited about it. We've got some grants coming up, and we just received where we're going to start building out around our schools, what they call Safeway to Schools, in the different districts around the town. So there's really a lot going on in making Glenville more pedestrian-friendly.
Local officials like you have to worry about the state tax cap. How do you do all this and stay under it?
There's really three principles. Fortunately, I've had the ability to have long-term planning when I've been here, 10, 11, 12 years, I'm able to look at how can we get to where we want to go. And there's really three principles. One is we cut our debt over the past 12 years by more than half, which has given us a lot of room now to start making some investments. We've protected our fund balance over the years. They used to allocate fund balance to pay for operations. We stopped that, and now we have that for capital projects. And that's been a big change for us as well, and has given us the ability to make these capital improvements. And lastly, we've cut operational costs over the years. So when I was supervisor, I became supervisor, we had 101 employees. We have about 80 now, so we right-sized, we cut costs, we got operationally more efficient, and those three principles have put us into the position that we are in today to able where we're able to make investments into our community.
Okay, that leads me to the next question, which is about the impacts of the New York State budget on localities. Obviously, counties are closely watching Medicaid right now. Towns like yours are worried about aid to municipalities. So how does Albany's $6 billion shortfall impact on your planning?
Well, we're worried about it. You know, we're cautious. As I understand the budget that the governor proposed, at least we are being held harmless from the point of view that he's not cutting other than extreme weather. Paving, I believe, is being cut, which is about a $30,000 cut to our budget. But other than that, he's holding chips where it has been traditionally, which is not good enough. We need to see growth in that support from the state, but at least it's being held steady. Where we're going to really see some concern here is AIM. Which is the aid to municipalities, direct aid to municipalities from the state. He has cut that from the state. He's put it on the backs of the counties to pay that. And I think it's only a matter of time that the counties say that's just something they can't afford to do. The governor is definitely pushing more costs onto local governments, and it's going to have an impact on property taxes statewide in all municipalities and counties.
Let me end on one political question. I mentioned your work with the Schenectady County GOP. What do you think the effect of the Trump impeachment has been for upstate Republicans and maybe upstate Democrats?
I got to tell you, we're hearing it. I get calls all the time. It's galvanized, I think, a lot of Republicans and even independents against the what they see as a fraudulent impeachment. I think the Democrats have made a very weak and bad case against the president, and it's kind of emboldened the president, I believe, and pushed support his way. I think we see that in the polling. That's happened over the past couple of months as this process unfolded. But we're seeing a revitalized resurgence for the president in the Republican and even in the Independence Party.
Do you yourself think he did something wrong in the handling of that Ukraine issue?
You know, I can't get in his mind, and I wasn't on the call, obviously, but based on what we're the evidence that was presented by the Democrats in Congress, I don't see an impeachable offense. Is there something that he maybe could have done differently? I think there's always going to be second guessing, but is it impeachable? No, I think the Democrats overreached, and it's unfortunate because I think it set back our country during the past year or so on something that we could have just wasted time when we could have been looking at other things for Congress to be doing.
Chris Ketsley, thank you so much.
Thanks, Ian.
Staying in New York, Carmen Bogle announced this week she will run for New York State Senate. The third-term Republican mayor of the Village of Cambridge is trying to replace the retiring Betty Little. Little is a longtime Republican from the 45th District. Already, Assemblyman Dan Stack and St. Lawrence area retired English teacher Kevin Beery are in the primary field.
When you look at all the things that are going on in New York right now, something that is really missing when you're listening to these discussions is the voice of rural community, the average person. A lot of great ideas, you know, come out of Albany. But at the end of the day, they don't really take into consideration what certain laws do to a average resident.
Like what?
So that is why I decided to run.
What specifically?
Oh, well, if you look at the different unfunded mandates, for example, I deal with those on a daily basis. I forget how many, you know, mandates over the last 5 years have come down for the village. Which has us increase our taxes to meet those requirements, which is also, you know, runs counterproductive to the 2% tax cap that we have. that really isn't a 2% tax cap. So one year I was only allowed to increase the levy by $6,000. But when you have mandates come down that, you know, pretty much eat away that, you start looking at your budget and trying to process, well, how are we going to still provide the basic services that we do and meet these demands?
Tell us a little bit about your life before you were mayor. What's your background, and how did you get into politics?
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in Vermont, and I had traveled all over the country. My first husband, who tragically passed away in 2007, he was a wandering cowboy, and we went all over the place. But after his death, I had to, you know, really assess, where do I go from here? You know, at that time, I was 28 years old with three young children, and I hadn't worked in the workforce since my oldest was born. And I decided my best shot of success for a future for myself and my children was to go back to school. Traditional college was kind of out for me with raising children, so I did online, and I ended up going with Kaplan University and chose their political science major. Got working in that and knew I was in the right field for myself. So I graduated magna cum laude in 2014 with a BS in political science. And shortly thereafter, there was a village election, and some residents, you know, knew about me and decided they were going to write my name in for the trustee seat a week before the election. And I ended up winning that election, and that's how I got on the village board. So I served for 1 year as trustee and decided to run for mayor the following year.
What would you say your biggest accomplishments have been in office?
Biggest accomplishments, probably starting to think of the future for the village. There was no capital planning in place, no thought of the years ahead and how to address the different needs and the different issues. One of my biggest accomplishments that I am really excited about is reviving the firehouse project. The fire department had been looking for the last 17 years at building a new firehouse, because our firehouse is currently 68 years old. And so, you know, many different board members through the years, you know, had started to work on it, and then it kind of got tabled. And right in 2015, I made that a priority. And so this year, we are actually at the point where we have a project to put to the public, and it is going to referendum this March.
Let me ask you a political question. Dan Steck is running for the same seat in the Senate, and he's got a lot of name recognition. He's already in Albany. How will you overcome that?
Getting out to the people. You know, at the end of the day, it's all in the voters' hands, and giving them a face to see. You know, I love door-to-doors. I love contact, because that gives them an opportunity to see you in real life. You know, I'm down in Albany a bit. I also work part-time for the 107th District Assemblyman Jake Ashby. So I kind of got in the last 2 years the behind the scenes of what goes down in Albany. And the most important thing that our legislators, you know, have the ability to do is the constituent relations. You know, most of my job revolves around all the calls that our office gets, where people need assistance navigating our state system. In regards to healthcare, in regards to DOT, in regards to, you know, different entities that they have to maneuver around. And New York is not really easy.
So you represent currently a village with maybe 2,000 people or so. The Senate seat that you'd be running for is obviously much bigger and has a lot more constituents. How is your village time translate to a much bigger district?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it would be my full-time priority going around the district and representing those and listening to the needs. You know, oftentimes we in leadership, you know, sometimes think we have the answers and think we know how to solve things. But honestly, at the end of the day, I think if you listen to people, they have the best advice and they have the best solutions for their own problems. So it's a very large district, absolutely. So I expect I will be on the road the majority of the time.
Okay, let me get you on a few issues here. There's a debate swirling in Albany about whether legislators should be full-time, should there be limits on outside income. What's your position on that? Would you be a full-time legislator?
I would could be personally a full-time legislator, absolutely. This would be my job, and this has always been my goal, you know, with my degree in political science, is I love the work of the political environment. I love the work of constituent relations. So me personally, I would make it a full-time job, you know, and legislators have different, you know, different careers, et cetera. And I think each person needs to choose for themselves what works for them and their family. But I believe in order to really meet the public's needs, you need to make it a full-time priority.
What's your position on term limits?
Term limits, yes. Yes, I support term limits. The question is where do we set that mark? How do we determine, you know, this is enough terms? I believe, you know, if you have the energy to keep working hard for the public, you should be able to do that. But on the same token, I think, you know, you need to reach a point where you step aside and let someone else come behind and do the work. To assess, you know, is it two terms enough? Is it three? Is it four? That's something that will require conversation, because honestly, to get real projects done, you do need a little time. You know, like for instance, I'm starting my sixth year here in March, and it's taken me from 2015 to now to get the firehouse project here. So some projects and some aspects do require many years of work to bring them to fruition. So term limits, you know, could possibly hinder that as well.
This is a Republican primary you're going to run in. What is your opinion of President Donald Trump? Did you vote for him in 2016? Do you plan to vote for him this year?
President Donald Trump, he came about because of the will of the people. You know, honestly, if it had been left to the Republican National Party, he probably wouldn't have been our president. And I believe people rose up because they're sick of seeing career politicians. I don't always agree with everything that comes out of his mouth, you know, and his Twitter. But overall, when you look at what he's trying to do and the goals he's trying to achieve, you can't discredit that. You know, he's controversial on many things, but I think that too keeps him in the public's view. You know, the public wants someone who speaks in plain terms, and he does. yes, I did vote for him in the last election, and I do plan on voting for him again.
That's Cambridge Village Mayor Carmen Bogle, now a candidate for the New York State Senate, running for the Senate seat being vacated by the retiring Betty Little. Mayor, thanks so much for your time, and I'm sure we'll continue the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Lawmakers are returning to Hartford on Wednesday for the Connecticut legislative session. And as usual, it's a full plate as Democratic Governor Ned Lamont unveils his spending plan. In this election year, the session is scheduled to end May 6th. Joining us to preview the session is Colin McEnroe of Connecticut Public Radio. Let's start with the governor. How's he doing so far?
Well, he's had a very rocky. His name is Ned Lamont. This is his first term as governor, but it's also essentially his first term in public service at any significant level. So he's comes from a very wealthy background, something of a neophyte. So last year, in his first year, although he had a lot of good ideas, he was not good at working with the legislature. This should be a layup. The legislature is overwhelmingly controlled by the Democratic Party. Ned Lamont's a Democrat. Should be easy to get things passed, but it wasn't. He just doesn't really have that touch yet. And so I think the question here is, in this second go-round with the legislature, can he do a little bit better in terms of that liaison?
How are the state's finances compared to some of the troubles we've seen in recent years?
Better. Better in certain ways. So there's a $2.5 billion surplus in Connecticut that is literally called the rainy day fund. You hear a lot of conversations about the rainy day fund. So, yeah, there's about $2.5 billion in the bank with another $300 million coming in at the end of the summer. But that's a little deceptive, Ian, because there are things that are really kind of going begging. One of them is our transportation infrastructure, which is really bad. It's so bad that it probably is, you know, causing a $4.5 billion to $5 billion penalty on just trying to do business in Connecticut with trains that don't work and highways that are clogged and bridges that aren't reliable and all that kind of stuff. So they're looking for a way to fix that. And then the other problem is, like a lot of states, Connecticut fobbed off a lot of its publicly staffed services to nonprofits. And now the nonprofits are going begging. They're not getting reimbursed at the same rate. Their mission is growing. The money they're getting is shrinking. So they're looking at that $2.5 billion rainy day fund, you know, and they're saying, hey, it's like Les Mis out here. You know, we're just fighting over bread and you've got $2.5 billion sitting there. How about opening up the wallet and letting a few moths fly out?
So who's the Javert?
I guess the Javert, well, I mean, the Javert to a certain degree is the Republican leadership. They don't have a lot of power, but they do have the power to gin up a certain amount of resentment about things. We are having a very, very lengthy conversation about tolls. Tolls are thought to be maybe the way out of this problem with funding our transportation infrastructure. We have what's called a special transportation fund, what Al Gore called a lockbox, except that it's not a lockbox. Like most lockboxes, drunk uncle comes in there and smashes it and takes the money to the track, or at least that's kind of what the legislature has done whenever they've needed money. And that's what the Republicans want to do with transportation right now. They don't want to have tolls. They want to go raid the cookie jar. They want to go get money out of that rainy day fund. So there's a fight going on about that.
And to be clear, my understanding is that we're talking about tolls for commercial trucking, not necessarily the average user of a highway.
Yeah, it's zigged and zagged a little bit. Lamont campaigned on trucks only. He got in office and said, you know what? That's not going to work. We're going to have to toll cars. People went crazy. The anti-toll movement started up and everything. He dialed it back without a whole lot of warning either. He just wrote an op-ed or something. He said, oh, you know what? We're going to do just trucks after all. And so they are going to finally try to vote about this. This is what they haven't been able to do. The Democrats haven't been able to muster a strong enough majority so that they can get out there on the floor and not lose. Neither House, neither chamber wants to go first. There's another problem there. They're going to finally vote about this in this coming session. They were going to do it last session, then they were going to have a special session. They keep losing their nerve because it's a very unpopular idea. I feel just personally as though the trucks only thing is not probably going to generate enough revenue to make the kind of difference. And it also seems like a weird way of penalizing one group of people who uses the roads and let everybody else get off scot-free. I'm hoping they'll consider an idea that's been introduced recently where that they would toll cars, but you would be able to get some of your E-ZPass money back in your state tax return. So in other words, you keep your records, you show what you as a Connecticut motorist paid in tolls, and either you get 100% back as a credit or some percentage of it. I think that might take a little bit of the sting out of this idea. But, you know, there needs to be more money cycling through here than what you're going to get from trucks.
Let's move to another topic. Now, if you're sitting in Great Barrington, you can go in and buy some marijuana. If you drive over to Copaic, New York, you can't. If you drive south to Canaan, you can't. So where does marijuana stand this session in Connecticut?
It's going to come up again. It's not 100% clear to me that it's going to pass. There are still questions about it. Some of the questions have to do with urban legislators feeling as though some of that money ought to get plowed back into cities which have kind of borne the brunt of and suffered in myriad ways from our existing drug policies. So, like, what are you going to do for us now? And maybe also you should be expunging the records of people who are arrested for minor drug possession offenses, stuff like that. There's a debate about that. There's another debate about from people just sort of saying, you know what, you're going too fast. Hasn't been studied enough yet. We don't really know what it is we're getting into. So Connecticut is, you know, famously the land of steady habits. We don't have a steady habit of marijuana in legalized form. We're not good at starting up new habits. So we'll see. This isn't a gimme. The money, I think, would be probably more significant than tolls are going to generate, although it would be for a different sector of the budget. But whether it gets passed or not, I think that's still kind of a coin flip.
Let's talk lastly about sports gambling. Now, there's another area where New York has gone ahead and seen it as a revenue generator. There's some debate about how true that is. What about Connecticut?
With Connecticut, and I don't know as much about New York's situation, Ian, but with Connecticut, everything is kind of gummed up by these interstate tribal compacts. So basically, we got into the casino business famously by working this out with another Native American tribe. So the Mashantucket and the Mohegans now have casinos, but the compact really kind of It seems as though you could be interpreted to say you really couldn't get into another kind of gambling business without at least negotiating with them. And of course, they want to have the sports betting on their facilities. They also want new facilities. They want facilities up the road that might protect them from, say, a casino in Springfield, to pick a non-hypothetical example. So they want stuff, and they also maybe want a piece of the sports gambling pie, and that raises questions about what the rest of the state's share would be. So it's a longer conversation. You just can't get those two compacts out of the conversation and just have a conversation about, should we legalize sports betting? How's the state going to do it? How much money are we going to get?
Colin McEnroe of Connecticut Public Radio previewing the new legislative session in Connecticut. Let's make a date and catch up when they're leaving in May, okay?
Thanks so much, Ian. I'd love that.
All right, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Remember to stay subscribed for the latest from the Northeast. Till next time, I'm Ian Pickus.